Open flattery is an embarrassing feature of public life. It is also an inherent feature of public life. On Tuesday, as PM Netanyahu met President Trump at the White House, he was engaging in such embarrassing activity. Some countries can express their appreciation to Trump by giving him an airplane, others must do with a letter of recommendation. Netanyahu presented to Trump a letter, recommending him for the Nobel Peace Prize. Does Trump deserve the prize? Less worthy candidates have won the prize in the past, but Trump's main achievement thus far is the Abraham Accords, a first-term achievement. In his second term, he is still struggling to achieve his goals. Russia is still fighting in Ukraine, Israel is still fighting in Gaza. Trump is promising that peace is near. A delivery might be forthcoming, but a current recommendation for a peace prize is more in advance than an actual purchase. Netanyahu's visit with Trump was an awkward event. He was hosted, along with other important guests, for dinner. That's not the ideal setting for a detailed discussion of policies. It is, though, the ideal setting if one wants to convince the world that the US and Israel are well coordinated, and refute any rumor that Trump is tending toward forcing an uneasy ceasefire on Israel. If Hamas was hoping to drag its feet in negotiations, because of such rumor or hope, a friendly dinner could be the right way to convey a sobering message. A ceasefire in Gaza is the key to many future plans of both the president and the PM. Without it, advancing the Abraham Accords to the next level is complicated. Without it, a peace prize is less likely to be handed to Trump. Without it, Netanyahu is going to have a harder time managing his coalition and his country. Alas, a ceasefire is a vague concept that depends on many details. These are less important to Trump, and more important to Netanyahu, for both political and substantial reasons. The goal of Netanyahu's blunt flattery is aimed at keeping Trump on board, as Israel delays a ceasefire because of its determined decision to insist on some of these details. Netanyahu told some of the people he was meeting in Washington that the leadership of Hamas is going to have to leave the Gaza Strip as part of a deal for a permanent ceasefire. He told the same people that Israel would not accept a Hamas rule by another name. The main obstacle to a ceasefire, the reason for which an agreement was not reached before the visit, is the mechanism for distributing aid in Gaza. Controlling the aid is the crucial building block if Israel is serious about uprooting Hamas rule. But it is a tough nut to crack. When there's no aid, Israel is blamed for allowing human rights violations. When the aid is distributed, Hamas uses violence to grab it. Preventing Hamas from doing such a thing is going to be costly in human life, and Israelis don't want to see IDF soldiers killed because they were tasked with guarding the aid for Gazans. Now imagine having to explain all these complications to Trump without losing his attention and convincing him that doing this or that is the key to taming Gaza once and for all. Netanyahu decided a long time ago to bet on Trump. How long? Some of his ministers testify that rejecting a ceasefire proposal last summer was already the result of his preference for Trump over Biden. Half a year before the U.S. election, the PM concluded that the Biden administration was pushing Israel toward a problematic resolution to the war. Had Biden made the calls, Israel wouldn't have defeated Hezbollah, wouldn't have attacked Iran, wouldn't have been able to insist on the elimination of Hamas rule in Gaza. Netanyahu frustrated many of his citizens, and some of his military commanders, by dragging his feet. He was waiting for Trump but couldn't share with anyone his true intentions and motivations. He was waiting for Trump without many illusions. He knew that Trump might not win the election. He knew Trump could be unpredictable. His bet paid off. While Netanyahu remains guarded, and Israelis remain suspicious, the mediocre level of trust they have in Trump reflects their caution. Most of them understand that some of Israel's most dramatic achievements in the war are the direct result of Netanyahu's bet. They see these two leaders having dinner and identify the root of their mutual affinity. Both are loathed in many circles in the wider world. Both have an ongoing battle with their respective countries' elites. Both seem to enjoy their ability to provoke an old guard of traditional leaders and diplomats. There's a clear hierarchy, there's mutual respect, there's an unsentimental alliance. They are not friends. People like them have no friends. They have servants, partners, rivals. And they have us, the people. In most cases, we fit into the same categories. Something I wrote in Hebrew. The IDF Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir promised that anyone who enlists as an ultra-Orthodox will remain ultra-Orthodox. These are, of course, imprudent statements. Zamir cannot guarantee that anyone who enlists innocent will come out innocent. He cannot promise that anyone who enlists nice will come out nice. He cannot guarantee that anyone who enlists secular will come out secular. In fact, he can promise the opposite. Ultra-Orthodox draftees will start their term of service as one thing and leave as another. As happens to almost all soldiers. The IDF is a place where Israelis change, usually for the better. The IDF is a place where Haredim will also change, also for the better. A week's numbers. Israelis are somewhat skeptical when it comes to completely ending Hamas rule in Gaza, JPPI survey, June. A reader's response. Jonathan Katz. Can't you see that Israel is losing the support of young Americans because of the atrocities in Gaza? My response. I do see it. But can you see that losing young Americans is bad, and losing the war is worse? Shmuel Rosner. Is senior political editor. For more analysis of Israeli and international politics, visit Rosner's domain at jewishjournal.com/rosnersdomain.